Good evening.
Recording in progress.
Evening, everybody. Thanks for coming. So last time we were having a homework assignment, and here's my note here. It was from a line in the first chapter, in the first verse of the chapter that we looked at last week called The Just or The Judge. And the line was, guiding without force, impartially and in accord with Dharma. And the idea was to look at your own mind and your interactions with others, study what it might mean to guide yourself or other people without force and with impartiality. So I wasn't sure what anybody would be able to make of that, but anybody have thoughts, ideas, things that you discovered or noticed in trying to do this, if you did try to do it? Jane, yeah?
Listening helped me.
Listening to yourself and others, yeah.
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 Before I thought.
Yeah, yeah. Other thoughts? James.
Do we want to use microphones? No? Yes?
Let's see. Are the people, Shofi, are the people online able to hear? Were you able to hear Jane just now? Everybody says they were able to hear, so I guess
okay.
We don't. I guess this picks it up well enough, I guess.
Great.
Yeah. Anybody else in the room? Anybody online? I see a couple of hands online. You want to call on people, Shofi?
Marianne.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I was thinking about it like with how I've been pruning trees, because when I prune trees, I can't just totally just hack them and decide I want to get rid of this and that. I have to look at the tree and pay attention to it and kind of think about how it grows and what its nature is. And then I do form it, you know, I do adjust it. So I thought about that along with kind of what Jane said, listening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're describing a kind of listening, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so it's not just you imposing your will on the tree, it's you're paying attention to the tree and sort of trying to find out what it needs. So yeah, it would be like that way with other people and also with oneself, right? You know, because we have our will, our preconceived ideas of what we need and want, and then there's listening to ourselves. What do we actually need and want? Yeah, beautiful. Jean, you had something?
Well, anytime I hear myself trying to talk somebody into something.
Yeah, right.
I'm usually in trouble.
Right, right.
Even if it's, a good encouragement, but there it is, my judgment that it's good.
Right, right.
And then I also can't hear you. I said that I...
There's a mic. John has a mic he's handing you. Yeah.
When I hear myself trying to talk someone into something, I know I'm in trouble. and especially when I think it's a good encouragement, because
right.
Then I'm
Yeah.
That's insufferable. So.
Yeah, and does any, you're probably the only one who does that.
Probably.
Yeah, I don't think anybody that I know would do anything like that, yeah. I see a couple more hands online, yeah.
A couple people online.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Hi, Norman, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I think everybody in the room can hear you, yeah.
Yeah, hi, everybody. So I was navigating this because our doggy had a healthcare crisis. He had to go to the veterinary ER a few times.
Yes, you told me. Yeah, it sounded very nasty.
But the what I wanted to share was around the poop situation.
Oh, good. We're always interested in poop. Yeah, it's very.
You know, navigating in the unfamiliar for him and the unfamiliar for us on what were the okay spaces to be no longer are so, and everything just needs adjustment. And what it became was we're all navigating the unknown. And so it just became this mutual practice of compassion, because, you know, there would be the, no, not there, over here.
Right, right.
He would look at us quizzically, and then he would go to sit down somewhere familiar, like, no, not there, over here. You know, and I, what was really refreshing was that he was offering at least as much compassion to me and Tim as we were doing our best to offer him.
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. Let's go to Andrew, I guess. Is Andrew the next one? Yeah. Hi, Andrew. You're muted.
If you can hear me, I was.
We can hear you fine. Yeah.
Yeah. The the main image that comes to me when I think of leading without force. This comes up a lot in education.
Yes. And, yes. Right. Of course.
And so the image that I always think of is opening doors. To open a door between a person and a possibility, a possible future, a possible action, an idea, and then, but you don't like kind of push them through the door.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of let them assess that part for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing, you know, nothing too earth-shattering there, but I do think that people mistake leadership for coercion a lot. And so that's an image that I tried to use to find an alternative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, all that is great. And that does seem like what the Buddha is saying here, lead by force. Not by force, but by gentleness and non-coercion and impartiality. Maybe Christopher, last comment, and then we'll go on.
Hi, yeah, I'm unmuted, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
For many years, I worked as a construction supervisor for Habitat for Humanity, and I would, you know, would have this large group of volunteers would come to the construction site, and they need to figure out what they were going to do. And I think the easiest way to lead them was to demonstrate, to show them, okay, this is how it goes. Mm-hmm. This is what you're supposed to do with this tool, and have a certain staff who was able to lead that, do that as well. So I would have to train the staff, show them how to do it, and then they would have to show the volunteers. So it was basically sort of a demonstrating
mm-hmm.
a way of leading.
Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm.
So saying this is how it goes.
Yeah, yeah. I think the Buddha also taught that way, just by living what he was teaching. And teaching more by the example than by words, certainly not by persuasion. And his dialogues with people were Socratic, you know, asking them questions and drawing them out and leading in that way. Yeah. Well, okay, great. Well, thanks for all of you who did take that to heart and try to look at it. Thanks for doing that. I'm looking at Pearl and thinking, yeah, and it's good for parenting too, right? Yeah. Well, that was a line from chapter 19. So here's chapter 20, the path. The best of paths is the Eightfold Path, the best of truths, the Four Noble Truths. The best of qualities is dispassion. The best among gods and humans is the one with eyes to see. This is the path for purifying one's vision. There is no other. Follow it, and you'll bewilder Mara. Follow it. You'll put an end to suffering. This is the path I have proclaimed, knowing the arrow is pulled out. So, the path, and the chapter begins with the broadest and most comprehensive teachings that define the path, the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, which the Dhammapada mentions a number of times. In the Heart Sutra, we state the Four Noble Truths, one word each: suffering, origination, stopping, path. So path is included in the Four Noble Truths. So the first noble truth is the truth of suffering, dukkha, that dukkha is pervasive and inescapable. All conditioned existence is dukkha, has the nature of dukkha or suffering. But suffering in this case doesn't just mean what we usually mean by suffering, that's which is unpleasant or terrible or that we don't want.
Can you speak a little bit louder, please?
Yes, thank you for reminding me. Dukkha also includes pleasurable things, because the Buddha's insight was that even in pleasurable things, even in the things that we value and like and enjoy, there's some suffering in them because there's anxiety within them. Because we know, even if we're not thinking the thought, we always know that that which we enjoy, we love, we like, can't last. So even in the midst of experiencing that pleasant, wonderful thing, we are feeling some deeply buried dread and anxiety. So in other words, good things aren't really good because we're going to lose them and that's bad. So it's a very big deal, actually, to recognize fully with our whole body and mind and our emotions and everything that we are, to really take this in, to really know this, the first noble truth, that all conditioned existence, without exception, has the nature of dukkha. Because when we know that, we are compelled to enter the path. There's no other way we could possibly live. I think we noted before that in his translation, Thanissara Bhikkhu translates the word dukkha as stress. Everything is stressful. So that's pretty good. Another word that is often used is unsatisfactory. All conditioned existence is fundamentally unsatisfactory. Things, even when we have them just the way we want them, are never quite perfect. They never are quite the way we think they should be. True contentment is really very hard to come by. So these are the first two truths, and they are stating the problem. Conditioned existence is dukkha, and the second, the cause of dukkha is clinging or attachment, which, as we can observe pretty quickly looking into our own minds, is pretty pervasive. We're clinging, we're attached all the time to what we like, to our life, to love, to pleasure, to happiness, and mostly to ourselves. In Mahayana Buddhism, the root cause of suffering, which is the basis of attachment, which is ignorance, is emphasized more than the clinging and the attachment. The root of the clinging and the attachment is ignorance. We cling because we think there is something that you can cling to. But there isn't. And that's why our clinging is so fundamentally frustrating, and that's why things never quite seem to match the way we need them to be, because we're basing everything that we think and experience on a bad case of mistaken identity. We mistakenly identify, we misidentify ourselves and the world. We don't see that all dharmas are empty of anything that could be clung to, so we can't cling. So these first two truths are the problem, that's the statement of the problem, and it's a pretty big problem. But the second two truths are the solution to that problem. The third truth is stopping, meaning simply that our misknowledge and therefore our clinging can be set aside when we have correct knowledge, and dukkha can stop. And there's a way to do this, and that's the fourth truth, the path. So that's a pretty sharp and clear teaching. It's very straightforward. However, in Mahayana Buddhism and in Zen, the sharp clarity of this gets quite fuzzy, because Mahayana teaching asserts, for instance, that samsara, the realm of suffering, and nirvana, the realm of non-suffering, are identical. That makes the whole thing a little different and more complicated. I mean, not really, but in understanding, it makes it more complicated. Suffering and non-suffering are the same phenomenon, Mahayana Buddhism teaches. The only difference is our understanding of them. And in Mahayana Buddhism, there are lots and lots of different versions of the path besides the classical early Buddhist teaching of the Eightfold Path. And although these Mahayana Buddhist paths may seem different from the paths of the Dhammapada, and although the Mahayana teachings may seem like they're saying something different from what the Dhammapada is saying, in Mahayana Buddhism, it's always understood that no, these Mahayana teachings are really the same as the early teachings. They do not contradict what the Buddha taught from the very beginning. So you don't have schisms and, you know, that kind of thing over doctrine, just different ways of saying the same thing, because people are different and need different approaches. But the Eightfold Path, which is here taught in the Dhammapada, is first, yes, okay, first of all, right view, right intention, these two have to do with our understanding. So the first two are understanding, right understanding. The second two, right speech. The second three, right speech, right action, right livelihood, have to do with our conduct. And finally, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation have to do with our meditation practice, which will bring us eventually to right understanding, which will naturally shape our conduct. So it's sort of all connected, right? So the Eightfold Path is eight elements that live in three baskets: meditation, prajna, samadhi, meditation, conduct, wisdom. And the word right here, right conduct, right meditation, right here, the word right, sama, means that these ways of practicing should be in line with the way things actually are, the way we actually are. They're in line with our natural best tendencies. And even though suffering and misknowledge is very, very deep in us, as we can observe for ourselves, sometime with great dismay, at the same time, it's fundamentally a distortion. It's not natural. When we practice the path, we'll be able to return to our natural state, and therefore we'll easily be able to fool Mara. Instead of being a threatening creature, Mara is like a kind of court jester, a mascot. And we'll also be able to end suffering. And we'll be like the Buddha, who was able to pull the arrow out, the arrow that's right in the middle of every moment of suffering. He's able to pull it out. It just falls out, you know. Doesn't even have to pull it. In these verses, we hear the word dispassionate. Maybe you noticed that word. Usually, in English, it's not such a positive word. We don't aspire to be dispassionate, usually. It sort of connotes somebody who's literally without passion, without warmth, without enthusiasm, creativity. But passion also means literally suffering. That's what passion, the word passion, actually means. And so dispassion, in this case, means having given up attachment to what you cannot attach to, and in that sense, being free of that kind of passion free of suffering. And the one who sees, seeing in the sense of understanding, seeing clearly, is emphasized here. The Buddha is the one who sees. And when we practice the path and the Four Noble Truths, we will see life as it really is. Next verse. It's up to you to make strong effort. Tathagatas merely tell you how. Following the path, those absorbed in meditation will be freed from Mara's bonds. Mara's bonds. So some forms of Buddhism, like Christianity, teach that salvation is beyond us. It's far more than we could possibly accomplish. And that's why we have to rely on others to save us. So in Christianity, it's faith in Jesus. In Buddhism, it's chanting the name of Kanon or other Buddhas in other realms who can help us out, because we are kind of hopelessly stuck and we can't do it ourselves. But the Dhammapada doesn't take that view. The Dhammapada definitely emphasizes that the practice is up to us, as it says in this verse, that we have to be diligent. We have to do it. Nobody can do it for us. The Buddha can, you know, give us the way, show us some pointers, but can't do anything for us. We have to do it. In Zen, you know, we, especially in Soto Zen, our way of practice, we have it both ways, right? We realize that we do have to practice. It's nobody else is going to do Zazen for us. We have to do it ourselves. And we have to pay attention to our lives ourselves. Nobody else can do that for us. But the ourself that's doing the practice isn't just our limited personal selves. It's really the Buddha who's doing the practice the whole time. So in that sense, we're constantly assisted by the Buddha, even though it's up to us. The word Tathagata that's used here is one of the epithets for the Buddha. Usually we say it means literally something like the one who just comes and the one who just goes. Or maybe you could say the one who comes and goes at the same time. The one who's here and not here, always. That seems to be more or less what the word actually means in its etymology. It's a name that indicates the just-isness of reality. But I learned from Gil's footnote here that actually there are other etymologies of the word Tathagata. I only am familiar with the one I just gave you. He doesn't say what the others are, but I guess it's a word with lots of these words are kind of mysterious, and the etymologies are not necessarily accurate. They're just traditional etymologies that have been repeated so often we think they're real. Next verses. All created things are impermanent. Seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. This is the path to purity. All created things are suffering. Seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. This is the path to purity. All things are not self. Seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. This is the path to purity. And those are verses 277, 78, and 79. So the three marks, 277, 78. Did I say that? 77, 78, and 79. The three marks of existence are named here. Impermanence, suffering, not self. Those are the three characteristics of any thing that could exist. Has to have those three characteristics. We usually see things not as having those characteristics at all, but in the opposite way. Even though we know it's irrational, emotionally, we think that everything is permanent. You know, what was here yesterday will be here today, will be here tomorrow. Even though we know probably there'll be a day when it won't be, still, we're living as if everything is going to be the way it always has been. And we're living as though reality should be able to give us plenty of happiness and the light, even though our experience tells us no. Still, the next day, we still think that. And also, we certainly believe in ourselves, don't we? We are definitely here as we think we are. So we don't see those three marks at all. And we expect things to be permanent, happy-making, and self. And every day when it turns out they're not, well, we have a lot of trouble. So look around at the world and you see what happens when there's a habit of doing this for untold generations. Of the three marks, it might be that the pivotal one is impermanence, which is not some kind of amazing and fancy Buddhist idea. It's the most commonplace idea in the world. Who doesn't know that everything is impermanent? It is not an exotic idea. Everybody accepts it and understands it. However, just like the Four Noble Truths, the first noble truth, it's not hard to understand and even rationally say, yes, that seems right. It's very hard to really absorb it in your whole body, mind, and spirit. It takes a long time to fully absorb this mark of existence. It takes the whole lifetime of practice. And you can see why, when you appreciate fully impermanence, you're also going to immediately appreciate suffering and non-self. They become quite clear when once impermanence is absorbed. And the word in these verses is disenchanted. You'll be disenchanted. And that's a good word. It means that all our life, you know, we're in a kind of state of enchantment. We're in a kind of trance. And since everybody's in that trance, it's very persuasive. We all, you know, we look at each other and we all say, yeah, they all think the same way I do, so it must be true. But from the Buddhist point of view, no, it's a trance, it's an enchantment, common as it may be. It's simply not real. Normal human life is not normal. It's abnormal. When we're awakened to the truth of impermanence, we are released from this painful trance, and then we can finally enjoy life the way it really is. Gill notes a subtle point which I appreciated. I don't know if it means anything to you, but if you noticed in the verse, the first two marks are all created things are impermanent. All created things are suffering. And the third one says all things are no self. And so that difference is actually important, because the first two, the phrase created things, means samskaras, that which is put together by the mind. All conditioned and created things are impermanent and suffering. But uncreated things, unconditional things, are not impermanent, and they're not suffering. And the two uncreated things are space and nirvana. Space is not impermanent, and nirvana is not impermanent. Space does not suffer, and nirvana does not suffer. But space and nirvana are non-self, meaning they're empty of any hard and fast reality, just like all conditioned things are also empty of any hard and fast reality. So all conditioned things have all three marks, but unconditioned things, which of course are very important to Buddhism because the whole of Buddhism is a path to nirvana, unconditioned things only have one mark, non-self or emptiness. Anyway, I really appreciated that point. I don't know if you find it meaningful, but I said, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, Joan.
What's nirvana in this context?
Nirvana is letting go, completely letting go, the unconditioned.
So non-self is empty.
Yeah, non-self is here, a synonym for emptiness. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, going on. Inactive when one should be active. You can all hear me, right? Inactive when one should be active. Lazy though young and strong, disheartened in one's resolves. Such an indolent, lethargic person doesn't find the path of insight. So the most important thing about practice is do it, right? Don't not do it because you're busy with other things or you don't feel like it. You have to have a certain resolve. You can't be lazy. And this is where I hope, anyway, teachers and Sangha help. That's why we need three treasures. Because that's where the Sangha helps us not be lazy. Everybody needs encouragement. Because any one of us on our own would likely run out of steam. Or if we didn't run out of steam, then probably we would make up some self-serving kind of effort that we would push through with some vigor until it crashed and burned. So we really need to cultivate our diligence, and we need help, all of us, in doing that. Watchful, next verse, watchful, this is 281, watchful in speech and well-restrained in mind, do nothing unskillful with your body. Purify these three courses of action. Fulfill the path taught by the sages. Verse 282, wisdom arises from spiritual practice. Without practice, it decays. Knowing this two-way path for gain and loss, conduct yourself so that wisdom grows. So, the Buddha is saying here, the situation is pretty clear. You can live your life without making effort in practice, and most likely you would then suffer and gradually lose clarity and vitality, or you have the choice to do the opposite. Exert yourself in practice and live so that there is more wisdom as your life goes on all the way up until the end. And practice, these verses say, involve everything in your life. Every moment of your life is part of your practice. Every moment of body, speech, and mind, which includes every human activity. So you live paying attention to the way you speak and act and think. And practice means that your life matters far more than you might have thought, and every aspect of your life matters. Every part of it, even the parts that you think are trivial and unimportant, every part of your life matters, and every moment of your life is a crucial and an important moment, not just the moments that you make a big deal out of. Speaking of big moments, did you all realize that in the Super Bowl halftime show, just as an aside, there really was a wedding. Somebody got married, yeah. So that was a big moment for those people. They had a wedding with 70,000 people in person at their wedding, as well as how many hundred million people watching on television.
The wedding was
probably pretty quick, yeah. But so we think those moments are the important moments. But every moment is that moment, right? Every moment. So about those verses, did I mix myself up? Yes, no, I didn't read the verse, right? I didn't read 283. Cut down the forest of desire, not real trees. From the forest of desire, fear is born. Having cut down both the forest and the underbrush, monks, be deforested of desire. Well, isn't it interesting and kind of amazing that the word vana in Pali means both forest and desire? Interesting, right? So the phrase here, cut down, I think, may sound a bit violent and maybe unrealistic. Actually, the Buddha used that kind of language all the time. I remember a long time ago seeing Gary Snyder's translation of the second great vow. how do we say it? Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. The literal Chinese says something like, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to cut them off. Like here, cut down. So this cutting off of desire, which as I say is a phrase that maybe makes us feel a little creepy, is actually the phrase that the Buddha wanted to use, because I think it indicates just how radical he saw his teaching. In other words, this is not a matter of let's just make things a bit better. This is a matter of understanding reality so thoroughly that one is utterly transformed, and the nature of suffering is so gone that it could never possibly arise again, that cut off. And in Zen, sometimes suffering is, especially the kind of suffering of attachment and clinging, is metaphorized as twining vines. Vines that, and I think they're in Japanese botany, there are vines like this that tangle us all up, right? Choking off the life of plants where these vines grow. So entangling vines, twining vines. And the way that you disentangle those vines is not by trying to, you know, pick off each vine. You cut the root. And then you cut the root and all the vines die of their own accord. And here, desire doesn't mean the way, the commonplace way we think of desire. Desire means entanglement, attachment, obsession, that which cuts us off. Next verse. As long as even the slightest underbrush of desire between man and woman is not cut away, for that long, the mind is bound like a suckling calf is to its mother. So here we see, and we've seen it before, the bias of the Dhammapada in favor of monasticism. This verse seems to be addressed to monastics, for whom feelings of sexual attraction are really dangerous and should somehow be dissolved, if there's any way to dissolve them. Ever since Freud, the Buddha never heard of Freud, you know? Ever since Freud and the modern understanding of sexuality, we have a really different idea and sense of what sexuality is compared to what our ancestors seemingly had. And we now look at these, you know, biblical and Buddhist ideas of sexuality as being primitive and causing repression and all sorts of trouble. But it occurs to me, you know, I've been thinking about this for the last 10 or 15 years, and maybe you have too. We have things like Me Too, where we see, oh, sexuality and how great and how wonderful it is. Maybe not so wonderful in some cases. And then all the, you know, sort of earth-shatteringly shocking instances of child sexual abuse from clergy and in families. You know, in families, it's way more common than anybody ever thought it was. So maybe if we're thinking about this, we might begin to wonder whether we postmodern people have got sexuality all figured out the way we thought we did in 1965. I'm not sure we do. And it does give you pause when you notice that every religious tradition is suspicious of and very worried about sexuality as a potentially quite destructive human force. So maybe there's something more to these ancient attitudes about sexuality than mere primitive ignorance. Our precept in Zen is to not misuse sexuality, which I think means that faithfulness, respect, honesty, and restraint in sexual matters is really important. And I'm impressed with the power of sexual feelings and the care that must be taken with them. I mean, they've already messed up quite a number of Zen communities across the country and in the world. It is so easy to hurt people really badly without knowing you're doing it with sexual misconduct. And there are subtle forms of sexual misconduct that, you know, occur psychically and psychologically. We know about this. So although we're not celibate monastics who don't have or validate sexual desire, I think this gives us pause to think about it a little bit more. Destroy attachment to self as you could in destroy attachment to self as you could an autumn lily in your fist. Cultivate the path to peace, the nirvana taught by the well-gone one. That's verse 285. Again, the word destroy here, which seems drastic and not so nice, but the Buddha meant destroy. He uses this kind of language to indicate how serious he is about the need to overcome attachment to self. It is a kind of a sad image, crushing a beautiful lily in the fist of your hand. Sugata, the well-gone one, or the happily gone one, is another epithet for the Buddha. Here I'll live during the rainy season, and here during the winter and summer. So the fool ponders, verses 286, 87. So the fool ponders, unaware of danger, intoxicated by children and cattle, that addict is swept away by death, capital D, as a sleeping village is by a great flood. Children, parents, and relatives are not a protection. For someone seized by death, relatives are no protection. Knowing this, the wise person restrained by virtue should quickly clear the path to nirvana. That's 288, 89. So you could say that one of the strategies of the Dhammapada is to really freak us out about ordinary life. You know, really kind of disturb us so as to motivate us to get serious about our practice. And it reminded me of the Lotus Sutra image of the burning house. Very famous parable in the Lotus Sutra. I remember reading that years ago in the house where I grew up and thinking, oh my God, the house is on fire. It really seemed like it was, you know. So in the parable, our house is in flames. You know, the whole house is literally burning. But we are sitting in the living room watching Netflix. And we don't know it's burning. There are flames in the basement. The whole upstairs is in flames. But we're watching Netflix. Everything seems perfectly fine. It is not. So that's the truth, you know. We are very busy people. We have busy lives. We have families. We have jobs. We have interests. We have houses to maintain and pay for. And we have all this because that's what we wanted. And that's what we needed. And we got it. But from the point of view of the Dhammapada, really, what's going on here is little by little we're being lulled into a kind of slumber. We're in a kind of trance, as we read before. And we really do need to wake up and realize that death is, in fact, coming very, very soon. Really soon. And we better get serious about our lives around now. And we better recognize what's really important. And we better do something about it. Now, the verses kind of sound like they're saying, leave your house, you know, abandon everybody, forget your family. But that would only make things worse, right? Imagine the fallout from all of that. No, that would just cause a lot of harm and suffering. So I think the real idea here is to simply love and care for all the things in your life, your home, your spouse, your family, make that part of your practice and realize that absolutely everything in your life can be and has to be a part of your practice. Which doesn't, of course, mean at all that we shouldn't do formal practice. We need to do formal practice. If our whole life is going to be practice, that is just going to be a fantasy and a nice little idea unless we have an ongoing formal practice the best we can in our lives as they are. And that's the end of chapter 20 and now chapter 21. If by giving up a lesser happiness one could experience greater happiness, a wise person would renounce the lesser to behold the greater. Well, that makes sense. Who wouldn't do that? Who wouldn't give up a lesser happiness to get a greater happiness? But it's noteworthy here that although throughout most of the Dhammapada, the Buddha considers the ordinary world of samsara as unmitigated suffering, maybe as in the last verses, last chapter, right? Here, he seems to acknowledge the view that most of us have, that ordinary life, yes, there are problems, but it also is pretty good. It can be happy. So here, really for the first time in the Dhammapada, he's saying, yes, that might be true, but the way of practice is much more happy. So choose that. Those who seek their own happiness by causing suffering for others are entangled with hostility. From hostility, they are not set free. So probably it's, except maybe in the case of a sadist who seems to really like have a lot of enjoyment from causing suffering in other people, most people don't particularly enjoy hurting other people. However, when you have a lot of attachment to what is yours, to what you possess and identify with, you are very often going to end up, in an effort to protect what you value, causing a lot of suffering to others. It happens a lot. In the ordinary world, we commonly demand justice for those who hurt others. We say, so-and-so should be brought to justice. And what we mean by that is they should suffer for what they did the way that the people that they made suffer suffered. But here, the Buddha is saying that when you hurt people, you become a hostile person, a resentful, angry person, and that to be entangled in those feelings and have to live your life entangled in those feelings is itself suffering. And that is the reward that you get, no matter whether you get put in jail or not, for your acts of unfairness and violence and thoughtlessness perpetrated on others. The toxins multiply, verses 292-3, the toxins multiply for the insolent and negligent who reject what they should do and do instead what they should not do. But the toxins come to an end for those who are mindful and alert, who are constantly well engaged with mindfulness of the body, who don't resort to what they should not do, but persist in doing what they should. I don't think I've commented yet on Gill's translation here, toxins, for the word ashravas, have I? No, I don't think so. I've thought about it a number of times, but I never mention it, because the word ashrava actually means outflows. Outflows, outflow. Tanisaro translates it as effluent. Exactly, leaking, which maybe we've talked about in other contexts, yes. So in a way, that means that asravas are the opposite of toxins. Toxins are something that we take in, right? That some poisonous substance that we take in from the outside. Asravas are leakings from our body and mind out into the environment. And so the idea is that when you are overcome by afflictive emotions, your system is destabilized and you start leaking out your vitality, losing your life force and turning it into a kind of poison that leaks out into the world. And imagine the world as it is, full of toxins that have been spread by all the horrible conduct over untold generations. I mean, you look at the world and it's not surprising that it is the way it is. Heedless people who don't pay attention to their lives and their conduct produce these kinds of asravas, while those who are mindful and aware, the verse says, and practice precepts, don't do that. Next verses, 294 and 95. Having killed mother, father, two warrior kings, a kingdom and its subjects, the Brahmin undisturbed moves on. Shocking. Having killed mother, father, two learned kings, and a tiger, the Brahmin undisturbed moves on. Well, we rush to the footnote. in which Gill assures us that the Buddha is definitely not recommending that we kill anyone at all, much less our parents and the king. These images are metaphors for the negative inner qualities that we are supposed to completely let go of. Like, and each, you know, I'm not going to go through the list, but each one stands for a specific thing: craving, conceit, false views, destructive views, attachment to the senses, and so on. And then when we purify ourselves of all of that, we can finally have some peace. And here I just want to reflect on the obvious point that the Dhammapada is very, very uncompromising in teaching that the answer to all our human problems, not just our personal problems, but the problems of the world, the answer to everything in the Dhammapada is the cultivation of good inner qualities and the abandonment of bad inner qualities. The Dhammapada completely ignores all externals, all political programs, and all efforts to improve our outward circumstances. It's almost the opposite of our life and what we think of as important and worthwhile. And when you reflect on how much we are all necessarily concerned with externals, and how little we pay attention to our inner lives as a consequence of that, because who has time, right? Who has the focus for that? You can appreciate what a radical teaching the Dhammapada is. Now, I don't think the Buddha is against taking care of and improving our external lives. I think the Buddha would be very happy with the medical care that we have now compared to the medical care in his day. So I don't think he's against improving our external lives. I think that he felt like, number one, that's not his specialty. He doesn't know anything about that. Let somebody else take care of that. He's specializing in something else. But also, I think he felt, and he says it a lot in the Dhammapada, that when you pay attention to externals, it's very addicting and absorbing. And in that sense, it's bad, insofar as it causes you to ignore the inner life. And he felt like the inner life is way more important. After all experience always has two elements. There's no experience without two elements: some external object and the mind. If you spend all your effort on the external object and totally forget about the mind, you're kind of missing 50% of life, and the Buddha would say, the salient 50%, the important 50%.
Isn't that self-centered?
Yeah. Yeah, because the self is also an external object, right? Always wide awake are the disciples of Gautama, who constantly, day and night, are mindful of the Buddha. Always, 296, always wide awake are the disciples of Gautama who constantly, day and night, are mindful of the Dharma. 297, always wide awake are the disciples of Gautama who constantly, day and night, are mindful of the Sangha. Always wide awake are the disciples of Gautama who constantly, day and night, are mindful of the body. 299, and always wide awake are the disciples of Gautama whose minds constantly, day and night, delight in harmlessness, 300, and always wide awake, are the disciples of Gautama, whose minds constantly, day and night, delight in spiritual practice. So that's a lot of verses there with lots of repetition. And they're a recitation of the most important things that Buddha's disciples should be keeping in mind. Inner qualities that they would recollect as a practice so that they would remember always to cultivate them. And the first three are the triple treasure, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And these three always go together, so much so that you could say they're really one thing. There's no Buddha without Dharma and Sangha. There's no Dharma without Buddha and Sangha. And there's no Sangha without Buddha and Dharma. So these three always go together. Mindfulness of the body, like when we practice Zazen, we're mindful of our posture, we're mindful of our breathing, we're very focused on our body sitting here now. Mindfulness of the body is one of the most fundamental practices in Buddhism. And here, mindfulness of the body, I think, stands for all four foundations of mindfulness that begin with and are pervaded by mindfulness of the body. Mindfulness of harmlessness means mindful of precepts, mindful of conduct, mindful of spiritual practice. Here, spiritual practice is a translation of the word bhavana, which means literally cultivation, like cultivating a garden, cultivating an orchard, careful tending, paying attention, like Marianne was saying at the beginning, paying attention to the trees and how they're growing and how we care for them. The word often does mean bhavana, means meditation too, cultivating meditation practice. Last verses here. Going forth into homelessness is difficult, it's hard to enjoy. Household life is difficult, it's painful. Living with discordant people is suffering. A traveler is subject to suffering. So don't be a traveler and don't be subject to suffering. So here, it's hard to be human. Being a householder is hard. It's stressful. A lot of repairs are necessary, both in the structure of the building and in the relationships of the people inside the building. But being a monastic is also difficult. It's no solution. Giving up both of these and saying, well, I'm just going to be free and wander around, that's also no good, because you're going to run into all sorts of difficult people who might take advantage of you. In short, you can't fix the problem of being human by finding the best lifestyle. You can't move to Bali and everything will be fine. Maybe David Chadwick did that, but the rest of us won't work. No lifestyle fix is going to do it. People endowed with faith, virtue, fame, and wealth are revered wherever they go. That's verse 303. On the other hand, when you're virtuous, and here somehow I find it very odd for the Dhammapada, that included somehow in this virtuous list is fame and wealth, which are usually in Buddhism considered grave problems, but here they're somehow listed as positive things. If you have faith, virtue, fame, and wealth, then you can rely on people to be decent with you and to appreciate wherever you live, whatever lifestyle, wherever you go. From afar, good people shine like the Himalaya Mountains. Close up, bad people disappear like arrows shot into the night. So when you're good, you shine like the Himalayas, which are very spectacular, in the alpenglow, and they're blazing with light at the end of the day. You shine like that when you're virtuous. And the Himalayas are enduring, so your virtue endures. On the other hand, if you're not virtuous, your life is like a shot in the dark. Nobody notices while you're alive, and certainly nobody remembers when you're dead. Last verse, 305. Sitting alone, resting alone, walking alone, untiring and alone, whoever has tamed oneself will find delight in the forest. So this seems to be the answer, the final position of all of this line of verses, that just be alone, practice alone, pacify your heart, and live with self-sufficient virtue. Now, although it certainly does say alone, I don't think it means that the Buddha is saying everybody should like abandon everybody else and just be a bunch of isolated individuals walking around on the earth never talking to each other. I don't think he has this in mind. I think he means however you live, whatever your situation ends up being, and it's probably just your karma, right? After a certain point, you say, how did I end up like this, you know? Whatever it is that you end up like, love yourself completely. Love your life completely. Give yourself a good deal of respect and dignity. Recognize that with all your shortcomings and troubles, and everybody has them, you really are Buddha. And that's why you take such good care of yourself. Don't entangle yourself in others, but do love others without clinging. And be loved by the others without clinging to their love. When you tame yourself, you will be a delight to yourself, and you'll be happy in the forest. That's all you'll need. And remember the double meaning of the word forest, right? Forest also means desire. You'll be happy and content in this world of desire, in this world of external things, and you'll be able to use them as you will and as you need without the arrow, because the arrow has fallen out. So we gave ourselves the assignment of 2 chapters a week, and it's a lot of talking, so still I'm determined to see it through anyway. I hope you're enjoying that. It's great to read these and contemplate them. Okay, we're going to do groups in a minute, but before that, just a couple of quick things in case some of you online have to leave, because I know a lot of you are in other time zones where it's later. First of all, I want to say that next week, on Saturday, today's Wednesday, on Saturday, unexpectedly, both of our sons and their families are coming to visit us. So I'll be absorbed in cleaning up and cooking and cleaning. I'll be absorbed in cleaning up and cooking and cleaning and visiting with my family next Wednesday, and Marianne will be here to take the seminar. I'll be back the week after that. Homework, okay, if you want to do it. We always have low expectations, but we're always happily surprised when we find that somebody did it. It's a traditional practice, literally, to intentionally recollect Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, to bring up just the words Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and breathe with those words. So see if you can find a way to practice recollection of the Triple Treasure in your Zazen. See if you can do that. And any time during the day, stop yourself and recollect the Triple Treasure and see what happens. Also, in addition to, practice mindfulness of the body. Try to be aware of the body, not only in Zazen, as I know you are, but during the rest of the day. Stop yourself, take a breath, be aware of your body, and see what happens. Okay, so now we can do groups. We can do groups of 3 in the room and also 3 online. Shufi will put everybody into groups. And here's what I would like to offer as a kind of topic for your groups. I think we have shorter time, so maybe 3 minutes each person, 3 times 3 times 3, and then we'll just come back after that. What's your experience of, your understanding of, your sense of, your feeling about the First Noble Truth? All conditioned things are suffering, unsatisfactory, stressful, without exception. What's your take on that? Your own way of feeling your way into that. So let's everybody talk about that sort of spontaneously without thinking about it too much for 3 minutes. And after everybody gets a chance to speak, we'll come together again. So, yes.
Did you want to mention